Welcome back to American Scene, the show where we talk about movies with American in the title and what they have to say about American identity, culture, and values. My name is Ben Rosen.
I'm Alan Austin.
If you have anything you want to say about the show, any of our previous episodes, or anything we cover today, please connect with us on Twitter at @AmericanScene_, send us an email at AmericanScenePod@gmail.com, or find us on Instagram at AmericanScenePod. Alan, have I ever told you that you can use the word buffalo 8 times in a row and it makes a complete sentence?
No.
Well, in fact, you can, but we only need to use it once for now, because today we're talking about American Buffalo.
Ah, yes, of course. The American Buffalo, the David Mamet play-turned-movie, not directed by Mamet, which he, I believe, has done in the past with some of his own works. This film, you know, I'll let you get into the specifics, but I'm excited to talk about this one with you.
Yes, this is the 1996 adaptation of Mamet's 1975 play, directed by Michael Corenti, starring Dustin Hoffman, Dennis Franz, Sean Nelson, and that's it. The only three people in the entire movie. Didn't make a dent at the box office, barely cracked like $650,000. So our second in a row of films that just did not register in terms of audiences. It is a very well-regarded play, but the film adaptation just could not find an audience. Mamet, of course, the writer of stage plays and screenplays of various success, The Verdict, The Untouchables, Glengarry Glen Ross, which is a stage adaptation that I really love, and what a phenomenal cast in that. The Edge, Wag the Dog, and Ronin.
I would say of all the ones you mentioned, I'm gonna put my actor pants on for this episode, because this is the first movie we've watched in a long time that reminded me how much I love acting. Being that I'm more of a stage actor generally, you watch films, you admire their skill and technique, but when you watch a movie like this, you want to be there. And while I was watching, I texted our mutual friend Rafi and said, I want to do this play with you in 10 years, wherever they'll let us. I would play Teach. He would play Don.
Of course. Of course. Great casting between the two.
Thank you. For sure. So while I was watching this, my point is, while I was watching this, regardless of what I thought of the film, I was smiling from ear to ear. You had said to me off air, it felt like a bit of a slog. Total opposite for me. It felt like it was going 1,000 miles an hour, because I felt like I was there with them. And I don't know how you feel about it. We'll get into it. There's a lot of themes to cover in this film, but the acting is really good.
The acting is really good. I watched it a couple times. The first time, as you said, I texted you and I was like, this is exhausting. Mm-hmm. Because Mamet's like Shakespeare in a way, where it's like it takes you a little bit to get into it because of the style, of the pace, of the dialogue and all this stuff. And like what Dustin Hoffman's first like 5 minutes on screen, he never stops. Except in the place where like there's clearly the act break between act one and act two, where he like goes home and he sleeps for a bit or whatever it is, you know.
The
electric shaver, which I love that transition, by the way. The audio transition between the like flashing sign in the diner and the electric shaver is actually a nice little bit. But he never stops talking. And that whole, I'm like, oh my God, is this what the whole movie's going to be like? And for a time it is, but upon the rewatch, I was like, okay, I feel the rhythms. I see the way the, like, I can see the gears turning and the kind of changing allegiances and things like that, as sort of Teach first convinces Don that they're going to do this thing together. And then slowly but surely, Don is like, did I make the right decision? And is this guy kind of, can I trust him to do the job, but also just as a person, like as a friend or a business associate, which, you know, is kind of part of the commentary that we'll get into. But upon the rewatch, I appreciated it more. But as a play, I think I would enjoy it more than I enjoyed it as a film.
I could see that. My biggest problem with this film is that the end payoff of everything isn't strong enough, in my opinion. It just kind of like comes to a, like it slaps you across the face with new information that you're supposed to catch on to quickly. And I'm sure if I watched it multiple times, I'd see the setup coming into play a little bit better. But the end resolution of everything was underwhelming for me as an audience member. And I think this is two things. You mentioned Dustin Hoffman. This is his spiritual sequel to Midnight Cowboy as a performance. And the references, the whole thing feels like an homage to Waiting for Godot. This feels like Mamet's version of Waiting for Godot. You know, Godot is whoever you want him to be, whether it be God, whether it be this guy who's in they're waiting for in town, if you know Waiting for Godot. And here, Godot is one of two ideas. It's Fletch and it's the job itself. You're waiting for these two things to show up. You're waiting for the big climax. You never get either. Instead, you get more of a day in the life of these three people. And while I think maybe the big action set piece or something like that would be too obvious and not what Mamet was going for, the lack of one actually to me was a little bit too noticeable for this story.
Well, the lack of a sort of big climactic thing like actually pulling off the job is thematically the inevitable outcome, right?
Right. Yeah.
So when you mention Waiting for Godot, it's like it's Waiting for Godot in the American milieu of this rundown inner city. So let me just back up and explain what this film is about. It's a very simple concept.
By the way, I just want to clarify before we go deeper. I know that there shouldn't have been a big action set piece. I know that that's the what Mamet's going for. These guys talk a big game, the what ifs, the big get rich quick schemes, all that. I know that it shouldn't lead to a big payoff. So I understand that. I wish there kind of was one just for my own gratification, but I understand what they were going for.
Well, to your point, and then we'll step back and reintroduce it and then kind of talk more about the themes and the Waiting for Godot and the sort of the American milieu of it all. But I think in adaptation, you could have gotten there and still maintained the exploration of this world and these characters and the themes as well. So like still given it the kind of cinematic payoff that you would want, but also continue to tease out and explore things that they do really well in the themes. I'm sure you could have done all of that, and that's my disappointment with it as a film, is because it doesn't take the play and build onto it and go further.
It reminds me, like, if there were an Act 3, Act 3 could be Reservoir Dog style. We don't need to see the job. We just see the aftermath immediately of what happened. That could have been an alternative route. Obviously, it's not what Mamet did, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah. And this is, again, to back it on up, because we didn't do this for Wet Hot, which is in the same vein, like a very very easy concept to understand. So this play, this movie, as described, I believe I pulled this from IMDb, long repressed feelings of bitterness and betrayal explode when three inner city losers in a seedy secondhand junk shop plot the robbery of a valuable coin. I wouldn't call Bob a loser. I don't think he's lost yet. I think he still has promise. Bob is the young black kid played by Sean Nelson here. I don't think he's lost yet. I think within the story, he may lose. And you know, having learned some rough lessons for these guys, maybe by the end of the film, he's lost. Maybe by the end of the story, he's lost. But I wouldn't call him a loser. Anyway, we'll get into all that. The losers are Don and Teach.
Yeah, and Don has this sensitivity about him. He kind of has this big brother, but much older man. But you get what I'm going for with Bobby. He believes in Bobby. He doesn't think Bobby's a loser. Teach thinks Bobby's a loser because Teach needs to feel better about himself. I think Bobby's on the track for being a loser because, you know, he's got somewhat of a questionable recreational past and he wants to be, you know, scamming and scheming along with these two guys he considers, at least Don, he considers mentors. He's on the path, but I feel like he's not old enough to be, in the context of these guys' lives, considered a loser quite yet.
Yeah, and you mentioned Teach needing to feel better than other people. I mean, my God, he is just horribly homophobic and racist. And in terms of how I feel this relates to the time at which it was written, 1975, but also now, you know, I think you see a lot of guys like this on one end of the political spectrum of a certain race and socioeconomic status, ranking his value, his intelligence, his skills inherently above those of women, or especially gay people, calls a lot of people fruits in this, and other very unkind slurs to gay women, and this black kid, specifically Bob, but I'm sure other races as well, he has to constantly rage against other people and feel mm-hmm. like they're in some way putting him down, or he's victimized somehow, and he's got to make his own opportunities for himself, and nobody's gonna, you know, nobody's gonna help him. It's very, very recognizable.
Shit, we're sitting down. How many times do I pick up the check? But no, because I never go and make a big thing out of it. It's no big thing, and flaunt like, this one's on me, like some bust-out asshole. But I naturally assume that I'm with friends, and don't forget who's who. When somebody gets behind half a yard, or needs some help, or some fucking rent, or drops enormous piles of money at the track, or someone's sick or something.
This is what I'm talking about.
Only, and I tell you this, Don, only, and I'm not, I don't think, casting anything on anyone. From the mouth of a southern bull dyke asshole ingrate of a vicious nowhere cunt can this trash come. And I take nothing back, and I know you're close with them.
But Grace and Ruchi?
Yes.
I like them.
I've always treated everybody more than fair and never going around complaining. Is this true, Don?
Yep.
Someone is against me, that's their problem, and I can look out for myself. And I don't gotta fuck around behind somebody's back. I don't like the way they're treating me. Or pray some brick safe falls and hits them on the head. They're walking down the street. But to have that shithead turn in one breath every fucking sweet roll that I ever ate with them into ground glass. I'm wondering, were they eating it and thinking this guy's an idiot to blow a fucking quarter on his friends? It hurts me, Don. It hurts me in a way I don't know what the fuck to do.
And Mamet does a great job at writing Teach to be dislikable. We are not really rooting for Teach in the slightest. If anything, we're rooting for Don, therefore we hope Teach succeeds on his behalf, but there is a clear written difference between Don and Teach, which is vital to this movie, because if they're both like Teach, this movie doesn't hold up. This movie would have never really sat well with me, no matter when I saw it in life, and it would have been a kind of a gross representation of certain aspects that this film is trying to push forward. Instead, you've got the Don character, who only becomes bad or irredeemable towards the end, when he falls under Teach's kind of not spell, but he has no choice but to agree with Teach in that moment based on assumptions. That is the only point where Don, who still feels bad when it's happening, turns bad. The whole time we're rooting for Don, the whole time we feel like Don is closer to his big break than Teach will ever be.
Yeah, but of course Don is stuck in this junk shop, which is such a great symbol, a great representation of where he's been stuck in life, kind of stuck around all these things, none of which are worth anything, including Teach, you know, and Bob potentially.
I guess Don is a bad guy in the sense that he's willing to rob for profit. But well, yeah. Other than that, you know, it's almost like we feel bad for him because a guy may have taken advantage of him. We're not sure. It's kind of left ambiguous. In that regard, Don's, we're not saying Don's this great guy. We're saying compared to Teach, he's the more redeemable fellow.
Yeah. I mean, he allows himself to be swayed by Teach in the first place when Teach is like, you don't want to send Bob in. You want to have me doing this job. Like, you want somebody with experience. I mean, this is stuff that Don's talked about at the beginning of the movie. He says stuff like, you know, action counts and bullshit walks, everything we know we picked up on the street. That's businesses, common sense, experience and talent, people taking care of themselves. So like, I think he does, because he's had Teach around so long that he's like, oh, well, this is my buddy. You know, I trust him. If he says he knows what he's talking about, he knows what he's talking about. And then over the course of the film starts thinking, oh, as I'm trying to press him on these things, he's being elusive. He's not really getting it. The whole thing touches off because, as you said, Don thinks that he's been ripped off by this guy, and it's sort of left ambiguous. I don't know. I think it's not that it's the principle of the thing.
Right.
And I think Don and Teach feel very kind of rooted in these kind of toxic principles that they sort of quote unquote picked up on the streets, like Don says, that like he might have gotten a great deal. Mm-hmm. He might have gotten the $90. You know, he didn't know that this thing was sitting in his place the whole time. But now that this guy, who might have like known more, been better educated or more cultured, he's got a wife, he's living in a place, he's biking to work, you know, all this sort of stuff, that Don would never do. Now that this other guy who lives in a complete different, you know, echelon of society has taken this thing from him, he's like, well, he has the opportunity to, he's got the book, he could learn, he's got an opportunity to do more business with this guy who's like, here's my card if you get anything else. Instead of seeing that as an opportunity, a business opportunity, he only sees it as a slight. And he sees it as an opportunity to get revenge. And that's very much emblematic of this kind of defensive, cynical kind of mindset that he and Teach are in constantly.
So he's shopping, you know. He's picking up maybe five, six things, comes to $8, you know. So I get him, I put him in a box, and then he tells me he'll go $50 for the nickel.
No.
Yeah, so I tell him, get this, not a chance.
Took balls.
Well, what the fuck? So I say, not a chance. He tells me 80 is his highest offer.
I know it.
No, wait. So I go 95.
Aha. Uh-huh.
We settle down on 90. Takes the nickel, leaves the box of shit.
He pay for it?
The box of shit?
Yeah.
No.
So what was the nickel?
I don't know. Some rarity.
$90 for a nickel?
Are you kidding, Teach? I bet it's worth five times that. The guy, he's gonna come in here, he plunks down $90 like nothing? Shit, yeah.
Well, what the fuck? It didn't cost you anything.
That's not the point. The next day, back he comes. He goes through the whole bit again. He looks at this, he looks at that. It's a nice day.
Yeah.
Then he tells me he's the guy who was in here yesterday. He bought the buffalo off me. And do I maybe have some other articles of interest?
Yeah.
So I tell him, not offhand. And he says, could I get in touch with him? I get some in. He leaves his card. I'm supposed to call him. I get something else in, huh?
Uh-huh.
He comes in here like I'm his fucking doorman.
Mm-hmm.
He takes me off my coin, and will I call him, I find another one?
You're going to get him now.
Oh, you know I am.
Yeah. You can tell that this is a cycle these two guys do all the time, to varying levels of seriousness and extremism. It's their life in a snow globe, kind of like Myth of American Sleepover. They don't leave town. This is where they stay. This is the cycle. Bobby is probably a version of Don when Don was younger. Young kid, trying to make friends, trying to like figure out how to succeed, opened himself a pawn shop or junk shop, whatever you want to call it, and made good, but still has that desire for more. I haven't gotten enough, blah, blah, blah. He is a very recognizable figure. Both are. All three are. But Don is definitely the most... I'm not counting Bobby. This is between Don and Teach, being that they're the adults. I put that in quotes. But Don is the one who, I think, sees the world in a better way regardless. He's not mean about Ruth and Gracie. He's not mean about Bobby. And he's, instead of, it's very easy for the Teach character to be like, young black kid's a junkie, duh. And Don's like, stop that. Like, the kid's on his way up. The kid's not that. And, you know, the build of Teach, you can tell the N-word is sitting on his lips the whole movie. And by the time he releases the vile word, it's so well timed that it flips the movie into a real dark place. And I thought, because they introduced a gun, because there were a couple other things, you know, circling, that we were going to go, that was going to be the payoff that I was looking for. Never quite gets there. But when he does say that awful word, it's extremely powerful. The fact that he has not used that, Mamet didn't have Teach say it until that point, was a very powerful bit of writing. And I just want to like say that this movie has the undertones, and it builds that when it releases certain aspects, it hits home.
Absolutely. And I think it's only towards the end when Teach refers to Bob as a junkie, and that's when Don finally pushes back. The whole way through the film, Don isn't really saying, well, don't call Ruth and Gracie dykes, don't call this guy a fruit. Like, he is not pushing back on any of that as well. Like, you can tell he's kind of accepted for the most part until the end that this is just who Teach is. And that's another aspect of sort of this kind of culture, you know, that right. is definitely a little too accepting of that sort of behavior.
It would have been unrealistic writing to have Don constantly push back.
Oh, for
because
sure.
you've got to think that Don at this point is just like brushing Teach off. You know, like they're in the confines of a one-on-one conversation. If he said anything, it would just send Teach off onto another tirade. And Don at this point has just like learned to ignore certain aspects of Teach, and their chemistry in this film and the right Mamet's rap. It's a very well-written play that has been turned into a movie, from what I can tell.
The only time, actually, that Don does push back is when he feels insulted by Teach. He feels personally insulted by Teach. And I think, yeah, of course, we're all going to defend ourselves if someone gets a little too personal, but that he doesn't defend his friends, but he's going to get, he might even come to blows if it wouldn't, in that moment when Teach refers to something in their past or something like that, or says that he's bullshit or whatever it is. And the two are bullshit. Right. But whenever either of them are called on their bullshit by one or the other, that's when things get touchy. That's when things get really explosive. No one wants to be, you know, neither of them want to be called on the reality that I love when... the reality that neither of them know what the fuck they're talking about.
Right.
And I love that scene when, I think it starts when Teach says, he talks about, this is what I'm saying to you. One thing makes all the difference in the world, knowing what the fuck you're talking about. It's so rare.
You want to quiz me on some coins? You want to show some coins to me? List prices, the blue book?
You want to see the book?
Sure.
I just picked it up last week.
Oh.
The values aren't current.
Uh-huh.
Silver.
Uh-huh.
What's a rarity?
Well, that's got to be fairly steady, huh?
I'm saying against what isn't.
Uh-huh.
But the book gives you the general idea.
You got to have a feeling for your subject.
The book can give you that.
This is what I'm saying to you. One thing makes all the difference in the world.
What?
Knowing what the fuck you're talking about. And it's so rare, Don. It's so rare. What do you think a 1929 S. Lincoln head penny with the wheat on the back is worth? We gotta know what condition we're talking about.
Okay, what condition?
Any of them. You tell me.
Well, pick one.
Okay. I'm gonna pick an easy one. Excellent condition. 1929 S.
It's worth about $36.
No.
More?
Well, guess.
Just tell me, is it more or less?
What do you think?
More.
No.
Okay. It's worth, I gotta say, 1860.
No.
Then I give up.
20 fucking cents.
You're full of shit.
My mother's great.
Give me that fucking book. Go beat that.
That's what I'm saying, Don. You gotta know what you're talking about.
You wanna take the book?
Nah, fuck the book. What am I gonna do? Leaf through the book for hours on end? The important thing is to have the idea.
Yeah.
And of course, the name Teach. You think, oh, is this guy very learned? He's got a bunch of books in his hotel room when he's there. It's all for show.
Yeah.
Because the second that Don is like, here, why don't you look in this book, you know, for reference, so you know what you're talking about, or you know what you're looking for when you go in to rob this guy. He's probably got a collection of all these coins, right? You got to know what you're looking for. He immediately tosses the book back and was like, what, am I going to read this whole thing? You know, I know what I'm doing. Yeah. I'll just go in. I'll steal everything. Sure. It's just, you know, they're both just making it up as they go along. And that's, as you said, when you alluded to Waiting for Godot, it's a lot of these back and forths. It's a lot of these evolving conversation. There's kind of like, there's a rhythm to it of if this, then that, and if that, then this. And it all kind of just goes in a circle to the point where like, well, they were never going to actually do it. None of this actually mattered. And as you said, they're just going to end up here again tomorrow. It's just going to be the same thing. Teach is going to come in. He's going to be pissed about something else. Don's going to have something else to complain to. Bob's going to be around with the coffee and the pie. It's none of these guys are going anywhere.
No. And, you know, what a con man, confidence man, Teach is a con man. Don is kind of a con man, because if you think about the confidence aspect, Don's not too confident. Don is easily swayed. Don is constantly chain smoking and nervous and going all over the place and trying to read the paper when he's clearly got stuff on his mind. He's constantly trying to, you know, recenter himself, whereas Teach is on autopilot in terms of, like you say, bullshitting. Teach knows that he can pull Don's ear. Teach has done it for years, theoretically. Teach knows that he can get under Don's skin the way when he wants to. He knows Teach is very confident. Don is not as much. And that's what sets this movie in motion. There's a lot of what you're saying. It's just, it's very deep. And I actually think, you know, the mammoth of it all, the fast-paced dialogue, the this, the that, the other, hits you over the head pretty hard, like you said, in the first 20 minutes. But I think it paces itself better as it goes. Like, in the first couple of, I think, like, the first 5 minutes, the names Bob and Don are said each 15 times. No, Bob, can't do that, Bob. Did you eat something, Bob? No, Don, I didn't, Don. Here's your thing, Don. That's very, like, that's what hits you over the head. And you're like, all right, all right, all right, all right. And then once it gets into groove, I'm actually grateful for all the Bobs and Dons because I know exactly who they are 25 minutes in.
Yeah, I agree. It does get to pacing itself a lot better, but it is kind of the sort of quintessential Mammoth dialogue. Yeah. Like when you think of whatever you know about Mammoth is that he's got this really fast-paced dialogue. People repeat themselves. People call each other by their names. Like, there was one moment, I forget what the line was. I'm sure it happens many more times, but it's like, da-da-da-da, yeah, da-da-da, yeah. It's the cadence and the rhythm is so quintessentially Mammoth, but it does work in service of the characters and the ideas of this movie. Ultimately, the first, again, we'll forgive the first few minutes for taking time to need to get into yeah. it. The reactions from this movie, I looked this up on Wikipedia because I was looking for, you know, some more analysis to kind of like dig into all the stuff that we're talking about. And two reviewers both touched on the same things that we're talking about. Stephen Holden called it an ugly fable of American free enterprise at the bottom of the food chain. American Buffalo folds a stylized parody of American gangster movies into a bleak Samuel Beckett vision that is wide enough to accommodate many interpretations. Beckett, of course, who wrote Waiting for Godot, about two people stuck in one place conversing, waiting for someone who never shows up, much like in the film. And I feel like Fletcher is the person they're waiting for, the guy who knows what the fuck he's talking about as a good card player. Don and Teach both agree that he's a good card player. Don starts out the film saying, Fletcher's a stand-up guy. He knows he's got the lay of the land. You drop him in any city by the end of the night, he's got the whole town wired. Like, I don't know that, you know, we never get to meet Fletcher, so we don't know if he can live up to all this hype, but you do get the sense that he is kind of the other side of the coin to Teach, because at the end of the film, you hear that Fletcher's in the hospital and everybody's showing up. Everybody's going to go visit him tomorrow. I don't think they would show up for Teach. They'd be like, oh, well, that's Teach. Of course, it was inevitable. Whatever was going to happen to him, of course, he'd get mugged.
Yeah. And of course, as someone who knows what they're going for, I know Fletcher is never going to show up, not only because Waiting for Godot, but because his name's not in the opening credits. Like, there's literally three names. So you know Fletch is never showing up. But Teach gets such a joy out of talking about how he cheats at cards, how Fletch cheats at cards, because it's just another way for Teach to tell Don, nobody's better than me. Like, I know you think of him as this godlike figure, but no.
Come on, Walt. I mean, forget with the job and all.
You live in a world of your own, Don.
Fletch cheats at cards.
Yes.
I don't believe you.
Ah, you can't take the truth.
No, I am sorry. I'm playing this fucking game.
And you don't know what goes on.
I leave Fletcher alone in my store. He could take me off any time, day and night. What are you telling me, Walt? This is nothing but poison. I don't want to hear it.
And this is what you say?
Yes, it is.
Think back, Donnie. Last night, on one hand, you lost $200. You got the straight. You stand pat. I go down before the draw.
Yeah.
He's got what?
Huh? A flush.
That is correct. How many did he take?
What?
How many did he take?
One.
No. Two, Don. He took two.
Yeah, he took two that hand.
He takes two on your standing pat. You kicked him $30. He draws two and comes out with a flush. And spills his fucking Fresco.
Yeah.
Oh, you remember that?
Yeah.
And we look down.
Yeah.
When we look back, he's come up with a king high flush. After he has drawn two. Better than that, Don. You knew you had him beaten. You were right.
Could happen.
Donnie.
Yeah?
Donnie. He laid down five red cards, a hard flush to the king.
Yeah?
I swear to God, as I am standing here, that when I threw my hand and when you raised me out, that I folded the king of hearts.
You never called him out?
No.
How come?
He ain't got the address again.
I told you he didn't. He's cheating. You didn't say anything?
It's not my responsibility to cause bloodshed. I'm not your keeper. You want to face facts, okay.
I can't believe this, Deej.
Friendship is marvelous.
You couldn't say a word?
I tell you now.
He was cheating. You couldn't say anything.
Don, I see you're put out. You find out this guy's a cheat.
According to you.
And I love that moment, too, because what he's saying is, I noticed it, but I didn't call it out. And Don's really upset about that. He's like, why wouldn't you call it? He's like, well, I'm not your keeper. I'm not here to cause bloodshed, Teach says. And I'm like, right. But that's all you're doing throughout this. He literally causes bloodshed in the movie. He, as you said, he's on autopilot. This is all the bullshit he does all the time. He doesn't realize that he is causing bloodshed among these people. He is driving a wedge between Don and Bob. That is his mm-hmm. purpose throughout the play. And he's going to sit here and say, well, I wasn't going to say anything. It's a very good performance, to be completely honest. Like, it's
phenomenal.
Just like, God, very, just very, very hateable. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just, there are aspects of, like I said, I was grinning the entire time. The monologues, and you know, when you do a film adaptation of a play, monologues aren't as impressive. These were like, this was an impressive set of performances, and I am chock full of no knowledge on Dennis Franz, really. Like, I think I've seen him in a few things here or there, but never carrying... I've never watched NYPD Blue, is my point.
Multiple Emmy winner.
Yeah, like...
I mean, by this time, had won, I think, 2 or 3 Emmys, but by the time this
so
movie came
was,
out...
So he was... Okay, yeah. So if you put Alan and Ben in 1996 alertness, we would be like, wow, what good casting, like... I'm excited for this. Me watching it now, I'm like, Dennis Franz must be who they couldn't get at the time. I don't know. Like,
no, yeah,
totally
I'm sure
unfair.
He was a huge,
yeah.
Huge get. I'm yeah. sure. And I don't have much familiarity with him either, but I'm sure that he was also a theater guy. Like I have
probably.
A feeling, I have a sense yeah. that he was probably a theater guy in the same way that Dustin Hoffman is. So yeah. Another review, Lisa Schwartzbaum of Entertainment Weekly said, American Buffalo is about nothing less Mehmetian than commerce, friendship, betrayal, despair, and American hustle. Which I think this film is very much in conversation with a lot of the ideas, a lot of the same kinds of characters as American Hustle. I think you can draw a direct line between Teach and Christian Bale, don't you think, right?
Yeah, yes, but... One is way more likable than the other, so I don't want to like do a straight on comparison of, but they are the two who, it's so hard because Christian Bale was so successful in the movie, and Teach is not successful at all. He doesn't even win his local poker game. So, but I get the idea of what you're saying. Guy who's looking for the edge, guy who has a lot of street smarts, but I would say that Teach is more of a blowhard than Christian Bale's character in American Hustle. Christian Bale's character wasn't an egomaniac. He was more like, let's keep a low profile and continue to succeed kind of deal. So they are two different types, but cut from the same cloth in some regards.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities between the films in terms of we have these kind of low-life characters scheming together, betrayal, kind of changing allegiances throughout the film, the quickness of a lot of the dialogue, to be quite frank, the exhaustion I felt in some places watching it, chasing after access to a kind of life and a part of society they'll never actually achieve. But I think that American Hustle is more hopeful than American Buffalo. American Buffalo says this life for these people is inescapable. And I think American Hustle at the end of the movie, the bad people get their comeuppance. People trying to do good get their comeuppance, like Jeremy Renner. But Christian Bale and Amy Adams are able to go straight, forge a good life for themselves. And it does have a much happier ending than American Buffalo does.
Well, I was going to say that I think you can make more of a comparison to Bradley Cooper's character with Teach.
Oh, yeah.
Someone.
Okay.
Way overconfident, who will do whatever it takes for different reasons. I feel like Bradley Cooper's is more for recognition and arrogance, but Teach's is more for the high of gambling, the high of, you know, getting the job, succeeding at it. More so, I don't think Teach ever thinks he'll live a life of fame and fortune. I think Teach strives for what can get him through reputation-wise the next day and what can get... he needs the bare minimum to live. I think it's more about bragging rights and the high of the gamble of it all for Teach, where Cooper wants fame and fortune, but both are nefarious. All these people are nefarious, but they're a little bit more spiritually connected than Bale and Teach.
Yeah, and even though the first 5 minutes of Teach's introduction was part of the exhaustion I felt, it is such a great introduction to his character, because he's going on for 5 minutes about how he feels slighted by Ruth and Gracie and how selfless he is. And of course I would, you know, I just grabbed a piece of crust off their plate. They were finished. They're just sitting there yapping and they think that I'm like taking from them. Well, like, whatever, I would be happy to share with them. If somebody's late on rent, I'd be totally okay to help them. Like, this guy's never helping anybody on rent. This guy's never digging into his own pocket for something unless he can get something out of it.
Absolutely. And I even got a sense that, and this is part of his misogyny, that he might have like a thing for Gracie. And the fact that she will never like him back really ticks him off. Like I definitely got that kind of hint as well, that he's so vengeful for so many reasons. And that's one of them. Maybe I'm reading into it a little bit much, but I definitely picked up that he likes her and she'll never like him back. And that's another reason he gets mad.
I mean, that could be it. It could just be hating anybody who is a little bit more well off, a little bit more comfortable in life. Like, these two are obviously happy together. They have a functional relationship. I also don't think that he's gotten laid in a very long time, because he has that other, you see what his hotel room looks like, but also you have that other line where he's like, guys like that, I'd like to fuck their wives.
Yeah.
I'm like, Jesus Christ, dude. Like, he wants things that belong to other people. So maybe it is an attraction to Gracie. Well, it's like, you know, I'm better than Ruthie. I should have Gracie.
Yeah. And you mentioned the line about you put Fletch in a town. I had that marked as definite soundbite drop for the release of this episode.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. I'll get it in there. Yeah. Maybe I'll get it in right here in case there wasn't a place earlier to drop it in.
There's one thing, Bob. Action counts. Action talks and bullshit walks. The only thing, I'm trying to teach you something.
Okay.
Now you take Fletcher.
Fletch?
Now Fletcher is a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
Am I lying to you?
No, Don.
I don't give a shit. He is a fellow who stands for something. Uh-huh. You take him, you put him down in some strange town with just a nickel in his pocket, by nightfall, he'll have that town by the balls. And this is not talk, Bob. This is action.
But, you know, you mentioned, you sent me the Steppenwolf article, which talks about, you know, the Buffalo nickel itself. You know, the film is called American Buffalo. This was the land of the natives before people came in and took it over. And there is a definite, that is the point of this movie. So I'll let you, because you're better at articulating than I am, go into that.
Well, I'll just read straight from artistic director Martha Levy's statement on American Buffalo at the Steppenwolf Theater. I believe this was written about a decade ago, a little over a decade ago, because she mentions the economic crisis. Granted, we were in an economic crisis last year, but plays weren't going on. So a similar place we find ourselves in to when the play was written, 1975. The central event of the play, the pursuit of the American Buffalo nickel, is resonant with meaning. Money is the great quest in the play, and the particular currency of that quest is an image of America's past, picturing as it does the Native American and a native animal made nearly extinct by the invasion of new Americans. Inscribed at the heart of the play is the story of America's history as a narrative of conquest, of invasion, of the coin of the realm. Donnie, Teach, and Bobby are American men of three generations. Donnie, owner of the junk shop in which the play is set, is the keeper of the past. The store is the repository for objects shed and forgotten. The youngest, Bobby, is gullible, dependent, sweet-natured, trusting. The middle generation, the man of the world, is Teach. Mamet is telling the story of these men in service of a larger story about America. The irony is that Mamet sets this within a social milieu of men who are outside of the real game, men who will never get beyond their financial circumstances, and will, in fact, always suffer at the hands of society's real players. What will we trade in for the acquisition of wealth? What becomes extinct in the quest for prosperity? The larger irony of the play is that these guys themselves are on the verge of extinction. Today, we find ourselves in an especially resonant cultural moment that can help us shed more light on Mammoth's American Buffalo, the financial crisis, or the COVID pandemic. That's me writing into this. That's not Martha. has thrown into high relief the question of values and value. We are collectively questioning what we have paid for the American obsession with wealth, and we are witnessing the stratification of wealth, the winners and losers, when the game falls apart. American Buffalo has much to offer in the way of a cautionary tale. I mean, she articulates it far better than either of us could. Of course, she gets to write this as opposed to us kind of speaking a little bit more off the cuff.
Yeah.
But I mean, what a great, great articulation of what we've been talking about here.
Yeah. I mean, people angry that they feel what was theirs was stolen from them, or maybe they got a raw deal. That's an American moment. The whole idea of, wait, you got one over on me? I can't allow that. Very American mindset.
Yeah. And I was going to also mention my first American moment. Well, should we get into? It's about time.
You're playing our song.
Yeah, my first American moment, I was kind of not in. In my first time watching it, I was not in on the poker game as an opening title sequence. Granted, I wrote it down the first thing as an American moment, you know, playing cards in a back room, dingy, you know, beer, cigar smoking, just like a very classic image in Americana. But also the idea of these guys and a couple women sitting around a table, taking from each other, their friends, right?
Yeah.
Having a competition amongst friends, gambling, deceiving, manipulating, right? Poker is, you're never playing your hand, right? You're playing the people across from you. You know, this idea of having to deceive others in order to take from them, and that they're not sitting across from people with a lot more money than them. They're sitting across the table from people who work at the diner. Or do they work at the diner? I can't remember.
I think they run the diner.
That's the impression that I got of Ruth and Gracie.
All right, mighty, mighty Boss Stones, calm down.
But, you know, these people are in the same kind of financial situation as they all are to one degree or another. I don't think any Ruth, Gracie, Fletcher, it doesn't matter how smart they are, I don't think any of them are getting out. And here they are at this poker table just taking each other's money.
Yeah, I think of like how many times the same $5 bill has changed hands between that group of people over and over and over and over and over. Yeah, it's quite an American moment. I think the idea of, you know, I think it's a more American moment in the sense of what you just said, rather than poker being played, because poker's played around the world, blah, blah, blah. But I get what you're saying. In fact, I had trouble thinking about my ratings thing, but it came to me before the show, and it has something to do with that aspect. But American moment for me is the, and we talked about this off air, the pig spreader thing, where the, okay, so hear me out. What makes it an American moment is a relic from the past, which was an American kind of thing. The farmers had to use it. People had to use it. It was more of a practicality kind of tool than it was. It just kind of stayed in this junk shop. It was a remnant of the past, which is what these guys do. They live in the past, their glory, their what can, you know, it's always this kind of, so the idea of that tool being present in the film is an American moment. And I know you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, there's also a great line that Teach says that I think is representative of what you're trying to say. He says, "If I kept the stuff that I threw out, I would be a wealthy man today. I would be cruising on some European yacht." As if accumulation of stuff means wealth. As if you just, everything he had, which probably wasn't a lot to begin with, then he would be a wealthy man. Now, that's not, wealth isn't just accumulation of stuff. Because, I mean, if it were, then Don would be, Don would be on a European yacht somewhere. But yeah, they're just two guys sitting in a junk store.
But it's also that mentality of getting ahead of yourselves. Like they think, okay, this one nickel may have been overpriced. Therefore, everything else that's nuanced and unique must be so overpriced and we should be making a killing, blah, blah, blah. I know Don references some memorabilia. I assume they mean World War II, possibly Nazi memorabilia. I think that's kind of what they're referring to. I wasn't quite sure in the beginning when he's like 1933, blah, blah, blah. There's a ton of this stuff. There's a whole market for it. As we know, war memorabilia, huge market. So Don and Teach are associating things that shouldn't be associated. Like, it's just, well, if this Buffalo coin and that war memorabilia is worth a lot, then everything my father had in his sock drawer must also. They're getting so ahead of themselves. They're never, ever balanced. And isn't it funny that he mentions being on a European yacht as a sign of success when most people look at the voyage to America as them finally having success?
Yeah. Or America being the land of opportunity. Yeah, for sure. Meanwhile, he's thinking, yeah, if I had a bunch of money, I would get out of here.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great point. It's my turn. Yeah. I wrote an unnecessary gun. It's why he got it. Even though it doesn't go off, it's not a Chekhov's gun. It's Mamet's gun. It's
right.
I think where we are in America in the mid 1970s, or I mean, at any point in the inner city, is this white guy thinking, I need a gun to protect myself. To, you know, I forget how he talks about the gun when Don realizes that he has it. Is talking about all these fake scenarios when, like, this guy's. I mean, he drops the gun. You know, this guy doesn't know how to use a gun for sure. He just got it that day, or so he says.
Yeah. And of course, Teach manipulates the whole idea of him having a gun into, well, I sold my watch to get this gun for you. He's such a gaslighting son of a gun, pun intended. So by the way, another line in this film I loved. I feel like I'm trying to stay up to death.
Oh, yeah.
They never sleep. Phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a great line.
My other American moment is the diner, just the representation of the diner. We've seen it before. We'll see it again. Small town Americana diner. You come here for your coffee. You come here for your pie. You could smoke indoors. It's 1975 or it's 1996, whatever. It doesn't matter. Blah, blah, blah. That's America.
And I do like diner coffee. I'll defend it till the end. There's something about it. Just like that being in a diner, drinking some probably terrible, overpriced diner coffee. Nothing better. I love it.
By the way, with this film, the ending confused me a bit. Like, it took me a minute to figure out why they were so mad at Bobby. Like, I didn't put together that they think the nickel that Bobby had was stolen. It just didn't compute to me why they would get so mad and think that him and Fletch were in on it together with Grace and Ruthie, perhaps, and blah, blah, blah. I needed to first off rewind the scenes. So I rewound, and then I had to go online and read the synopsis of the play because I couldn't figure it out. And maybe that's just me as a dumb audience member, but it all came out of nowhere for me.
No, I totally didn't understand it either. And that's partly to do with Mamet's writing. It is kind of elusive in the way that these people speak. They speak in a lot of subtext, and Bob is not a particularly articulate individual, and he doesn't know, and he's probably learned how to talk by these guys. Like, this right. is how you talk among men. So, like, these two guys are also incredibly obtuse in the way that they speak and referential and all this. So if he's learned how to talk from these guys, then he's not going to be able to say what he means. But yeah, you got the sense that they, Don and Teach, thought that Bob was scheming in some way.
Yeah.
And I get it. Yeah. Like, maybe they think that because he knew what the score was, then Bob and Fletch went and ripped this guy off. And then he got the nickel that then he tries to sell Don. And, you know, he keeps asking for Don for money. And maybe they think that Bob knows more than he's letting on. For sure.
And part of the problem is that Bobby kind of by the end becomes so inept. Like, he's so goofy that it kind of throws the whole movie off the rails for me. Because, like, if Bobby had any ounce of intelligence in those last couple scenes, none of this would have ever happened. But he's, like, flailing around, you know, he can't put simple thoughts together. And they never showed Bobby to be that, like, obtuse the whole movie up until that point. I just think maybe the movie had trouble finding its ending. Like, it knew where it wanted to go, but getting there stumbled a bit for me.
I don't know if it was just a bad performance.
It wasn't a great performance.
Not a great performance. But also, now that I'm thinking about it, like, why is this kid here all day? Like, I don't know what day of the week it is, but, like, shouldn't he be in school? Yeah. But then maybe I'm thinking, is he developmentally disabled in some way?
But you have to make that
that's
clear.
Why he's here, that, like, nobody is taking care of him. He's not, you know, school can't take him because they don't, you know, it's the inner city. They don't have, you know, remedial classes or special ed classes for him. Yeah, it's very hard to read into that. But yeah, it doesn't make the ending of the film any easier to understand. So I'm talking about things that could have been explored better in an adaptation. When you're just taking the play and really bare bonesing it, it doesn't help. It doesn't help the read.
And you don't feel bad for Bobby at the end. Because you're like, just get the words out. Spit it out. Like, tell them what you're trying to say. And how do you get the hospital name wrong? These are like basic details that...
I noticed on my rewatch, Dustin Teach is the one who says Masonic. Before anybody asks what hospital it is. When Don and Bob are outside... And Bob is like, I got to talk to you, and whatever. He's like, Fletch got mugged. And Teach says something like, oh, and great, and now he's laid up in Masonic. And it's the power of suggestion. And then Don doesn't even realize that Teach was the first one to say Masonic. So yeah, I only got that on the second time. It's very, very subtle.
And Bobby should also not, he should just know. Like, when, first of all, we talk about the performance being bad. Well, not great, so to speak. When he gets hit with the telephone, his acting as, like, woozy is so poor that it's just, like...
It's very theatrical.
Yeah, theatrical. Very over the top. Very, like, oh, I don't feel good. I thought he was going to die. I don't know if we're supposed to think that because they're not in any super rush to get him medical care. So it's, like... It was just a bad ending. I think that's what I'm going to chalk it up to. And it's I get it, what they were going for. They succeed to a degree, for sure. I'm out of American Moments. I'm ready to give it a rating if you are.
Well, I've got one more American moment.
All right.
It had to show up. Did you blink and miss the American flag?
Maybe. Yeah, I guess I
did. There's an American flag. It's in the end scene, which I also want to talk about, when Teach is destroying the shop. He throws, I think... a lamp, or maybe it was the phone, into a glass framed picture or painting of an American flag. And I was like, okay, they got it. It was this close. Nice.
Yeah. That last scene, it's a lot.
It's Teach says about 51 minutes into the movie, Teach has a rant about, like, free enterprise. And he talks about the freedom of the individual to choose a course he sees fit, to secure an honest chance to profit. The country's founded on this. We're not savages in the wilderness sitting around a fire. Another reference to Native Americans as well, to kind of bring in that thematic element of the American buffalo. This comes back at the end when Teach is destroying the shop. He's exhausted himself. He's so pissed off at Bob. And now Don's, like, throwing himself over Bob to, like, protect him from Teach's absolute just, like, temper tantrum. He says, there is no law or right or wrong, no friendship. The world is lies. We live like the cavemen. And he's resigned himself to this cynical view. I think he's finally admitting it to himself. But this is the way that he's lived the entire film that we've seen him up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
He has lived like there's nothing, there's no law, there's no right or wrong, no friendship. He has done his very best to manipulate the situation at every single turn, and it's still going to end poorly for him. And then he puts on the paper hat because it's raining outside, and maybe he'll drive them to the hospital, but I don't think he will. I don't think his car can start.
Yeah, before we give it our rating, I want to put you on the spot for a second.
Sure.
If you could recast this film using other actors that have been on movies we've covered, who would you? Because I'm going to leave the Bobby character out. I'm just focusing on Don and Teach because I've got two. If it would work, I think it has to be two white guys, but I think John Leguizamo would be a great Teach.
Oh, he'd be fun. Yeah.
But I have two. I have two in mind.
Well, this might have to be a minisode game.
Oh,
this would be a fun discussion to get into.
The minisode.
But also, I was going to mention, as I was Googling American Buffalo, I found Lawrence Fishburne, I believe, is playing Don. It doesn't have to be white guys.
But I was saying, I think Teach might have to be because
Sure. Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So that'll be for the minisode.
Also for the minisode, let's talk about some play adaptations, some stage play adaptations, feature film adaptations that we liked more than this.
Sure. Yeah. Cats.
There are a lot of
for
them.
One.
Oh my God, Cats is number one.
I know. You know. A little minisode spoiler, but James Corden as Don. Let's go. Sign me up. Obviously kidding.
Only if there's a musical number. Only if he can promote it by stopping traffic somewhere. And throwing like trash around on the street.
Oh my God, I would be much more for James Corden stopping traffic as Don rather than his Cinderella character. Wow, that joke is for only people who've seen this movie.
Oh, great. Oh, you know, I forgot to even mention just as part of the inner city milieu, but the cops.
Yeah, always around.
The sirens, always the reference to cops. Yeah. I thought that was a great
and they're afraid
running,
of them.
Motif. Well, it's funny. Teach seems to have some admiration for them, which I thought was added to this kind of idea of who this guy was. He says, cops, they got the right idea, armed to the hilt, social customs break down. Next thing, everybody's lying in the gutter. But the cops would be, you know.
Yeah, interesting.
Would be fine. Why don't you, you ready with your rating?
I am. So I give this film 2.5 of those red, white, and blue plastic poker chips that are like, you know, that they're very cheap. You get them at the dollar store. They are just, there's no denomination on them. They are just your plastic poker chips. 2.5 of those.
I love out of 5 or out of 4.
Out of 4.
We have not been consistent at all. I just want to say that for the record. We know
that.
It
doesn't matter.
So we'll just have to say every week, is it out of 5? Is it a 4? Who knows?
It's out of 4, just below a positive recommendation.
Very good. Very good. I came around on it on my second time watching it. Out of 4, I'm going to give it 2 cups of shitty diner coffee. As I said, I like diner coffee. I'm a fan. The ones in this didn't look good. I would never get takeout. I would never get diner coffee takeout. These guys get takeout. Like, what is no, you drink it out of one of those heavy mugs in the diner at the counter. That's the only way to enjoy it.
He says, like, where's my coffee? And they're like, it's not in the bag. I'm like, why would it be in the bag?
And how would you not know? Is it was like, geez, a cup of coffee's got to be like a little heavy.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's a wrap on American Buffalo. Thank you so much for listening. If you like what we're doing, please give us a rating, leave a positive review. You can give us your unfiltered opinion on Twitter @AmericanScene_, on Instagram @AmericanScenePod. And if you'd like to follow either of your patriotic co-hosts, I'm Ben Rosen on Twitter @NotThatBenRosen.
I'm Alan Austin @Alan_Austin_.
And we'll see you next time.